yesterday. We concluded on the basis that the department and the legal team would sit together and formulate the amendments to the bill as suggested by the committee. And I'm going to give the advocate Boshoff from the department to take us through on the process that they had undertaken in the afternoon yesterday and perhaps last night as well. The process is a bit confusing as you've been seeing me with the legal team. We're trying to understand how to go through the process, and members are not technical people. They're highly dependent on experts, and you'll be able to take us through so that we were able to follow very clearly as to whether the corrections or amendments or alterations that have been effected are in relation to the decisions that we were advancing in our deliberations as a committee all throughout the process. And I must apologize for the legal team and the official from the department, because programming just requires to see that we comply in terms of their program, and we are hard pressed for time, and we will make do of what is available for us. And I hope members will understand that. Now the time is over.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, the four documents that have been distributed. These documents are some of the more substantive changes that has been included into the section, so that one can get a better picture of what is the effect of the amendments about. And that is both to section 4 capital A and 17 capital A. Here, these are the consequential amendments as a result of the decision of the committee to ensure that an administrator and a council cannot coexist. The other document do have also substantive changes in it. It is what would form the basis for the A list of the two bills. The issues obviously have been focused on are those amendments caused by the conflict of interest, which have been discussed yesterday. And furthermore, it also provides the technical amendments as to what is in the other two documents. Chair, the Higher Education Amendment Bill, if we start off with this one, and Chair, I would use the A list. It is the document which got the heading Amendment Proposed to the Higher Education Laws Amendment Bill. We didn't call it the A list because it is not formal yet. There's amendments proposed to the existing bill, but it is drafted in the format of an A bill. Chair, the first important issue, if one read it in conjunction with Clause 1, is that the current language refers to a member of council would be affected by that conflict of interest. It also introduced a member of a committee of council. It is further important that the language that's being used in the new clause, the subclauses or subsections that have been introduced, those that is contained in in paragraph 3, they are the same as those that we've discussed yesterday, and as indicated, 7E was moved into this clause in order to avoid the implications of the parliamentary rules 249. So here there's been no changes to that clauses other than to move and to renumber 7E from what was before the committee yesterday. Chair, I omit to raise the very small amendment in paragraph 2 of that document, which is on page 2 in line 15, where the word raised been changed to a conflict or. And Chair, that is an issue that has been identified yesterday in the discussion, and the exact wording as proposed to the committee is what we've inserted in that technical amendment. There's nothing substantial that's been changed by that. Clause 2 of this document, it contains exactly the position as was put to the committee yesterday. The clauses are as we've proposed, and it was just put in that format. There's nothing that's been changed to it. There's no new language or words amended to it, other than to just ensure that there's no typing errors and that the words are also in line with the instruction that Chair, I've been also requested that I maybe it would be useful if I read out the new clauses so that the members can follow it more in detail. Chair, if I then can go back to clause 1. The first insertion paragraph 1 is it would now read that the member of a council or a committee of council, Chair, in fact it is a member of council and a member of a committee of council is what we propose. The next one is in line 15 on the same page, and it is reading, it is in the paragraph C, must before he or she assumed office declare any business, commercial or financial activity undertaken for financial gain that may, that raise we've taken out and we replace it, may, and we insert after race the word a conflict, the race a conflict or possible conflict. Here, the next one is to insert on page 3 in line 17. That is the one that is dealing with the insertions of just after 7 capital B, subsection 7 capital B, 3 new subsections, 7C, a committee of the council with delegated functions in terms of section 68(2) may not take a decision on a matter considered by it if any member of the committee has a conflict of interest contemplated in this section. Then 7 capital D, this subsection reads as follows. The member of the council or committee of council who contravenes subsection 7 C, D, and E, subsection A, capital A, and 7 capital B, after council has followed due process, may B dash A suspended from attending a meeting, or B disqualified as member of council. The next subsection is 7E. It reads as follows. The member must A having regard to the provisions of section 29(7) and 7 capital A to 7 capital D and section 34 and after consultation with the institutional forum, adopt a code of conduct to which all members of the council, all members of committee of council and other persons who exercise functions of the council in terms of delegated authority must subscribe, semicolon, and B, determine rules and procedures in terms of section 32 for an annual declaration, Roman 1, by which members of the council, each member of council committee, and each person who exercises functions of the council in terms of delegated authority, semicolon, Roman 2, of his or her financial interests and fiduciary role, the latter to include but not limited to offices, directorships of companies, membership of close corporations, and trusteeship held, semicolon, and Roman 3, of the financial interests and fiduciary roles of the members of his or her immediate family. That is clause 1. Clause 2.
Clause 1. You refer to section 29(7). Is that correct? Is there a 29(7)? Or is it an amended part of the bill, or the act that we don't have?
No,
I can't find a 29(7).
Yeah, it is in the principal
act.
The 7 is not amended. Subsection 7 is not amended, and therefore it is part of the main act itself, the Higher Education Act.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I can make the act available to the member. I've got a copy available.
I
only have 4 subsections.
27.9.
Yes, 27.9. I thought it's either 29 or it should be then, so it's a printing error.
It's 27.9.
I apologize for that. It's 27. So I move to clause 2. Clause 2 is dealing with the amendment that's been proposed. Is that on page 3 in line 20? The language that's used in the clause 4 and 5 has basically been retained in the proposed amendment. The new clause subsection 5 is basically what is the language used in the old sub 4,
And the new sub 7 is in line with what was in the old sub 5. But here, to make the amendment more cohesive, we've omit those two and we've replaced it with a set of amendments, and it reads as follows. Here, the new sub 4 reads as follows. An employee must, in writing, A, before he or she assumes office, comma, declare any business that may raise a conflict of interest, or possible conflict of interest with the public higher education institution concerned, semicolon, and B, notify the public higher education institution concerned of any conflict or possible conflict of interest before such public higher education institution procures any goods or services from the employee or organization within which the employee holds an interest. Sub 5, an employee may not conduct business directly or indirectly with the public higher education institution at which he or she is employed that entails or may entail a conflict of interest with the public higher education institution, unless the council of such public higher education institution is of the opinion that A, the goods, product, or service in question are unique, B, the supplier is a sole provider, and C, is in the best interest of the institution. Subsection C. The employee may not, on behalf of the public higher education institution, contract with himself or herself or any entity in which he or she has a direct or indirect financial or personal interest. Sub 7. Business referred to in subsection 4 relates to conduct that is aimed at receiving any direct or indirect financial personal gain that does not form part of the employment relationship contemplated in subsection 1. Here, clause 4.
Excuse me, may I ask a question again? According to if I compare your previous document to this one, yesterday's document, what happened to subsection 6? Because subsection 6 now is the previous subsection 7, am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And 8 is the previous subsection 7.
Yeah.
Did 6 appear or did I miss something? And then I also just want to ask a question on the supplier is a sole provider. What if he's not the sole provider, but he is the provider of the best product?
The first question is about the one paragraph that appeared in the document that was in the discussion yesterday. It is when we went through the analysis of the substance of it, there was a huge overlap with what was contained in the new sub 5 of this document that's now proposed, and therefore, in order to repeat the same concept, the same language, we've taken out that specific paragraph, but there's no change to the substance. The issue of the sole provider, the constitution principle is that in procurement it must be an open, transparent system of procurement which is cost effective and also efficient. If it is the best product, then it would be a unique product. If it is a product which is available from a variety of suppliers, then competition is what is required, because we are talking about public money, And that is where the sole provider is coming in. So here the intention is to ensure that if a competition exists, then the other party who is not involved and do not have the benefit of a direct input from any person within the institution would not be unfairly prejudiced. And that is the reason for this wording, or this language.
I don't agree that unique includes best. I'm not so sure.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you, Chair. I think that the issue of uniqueness, I think, was one of the issues that came out when you're dealing with patents or you're dealing with something in the market where you have no competition because you invented something, you have a patent, it's unique. You're not going to find another company that's applying your product in the market. So that's basically what's meant by unique. And I think that when we are looking at issues of best product, that opens up the market to competition. That opens the concept that we're trying to do away with of the creating of possible conflict of interest. For instance, it's purely a policy decision, but if, for instance, we look at our Finance Act for Parliament, we can see that as staff and members of Parliament, we're not allowed to do business with Parliament at all. So that purely is a policy and went to the extent of law. So when you're looking at the policy that feeds into this, it was the submissions that came out that said, look, we don't want to bar this completely, but there should be some level. So feeding into that policy is to say, let's look at the categories of patents or uniqueness. But the minute we say best, it means we're opening the process for competition. It means anybody in that institution can now come and say, well, I've got a better product than you, so I should be doing business. And that's what we're trying not to create through this legislation. Thank you.
Sorry, what I wanted to find out is whether we're discussing as it gets presented or we should be noting what we want to engage and it gets concluded in terms of presentation we engage. Just to clear that process of it. Otherwise, if we're discussing it as we get along, I could raise a few things as well.
We are almost there. I thought we must allow them to present so that we look at the gist of what we said must be included. Is it done? And then we'll pick up issues that we think we need to be clarified on. Then we engage on those. For instance, if you check the very issue that is being dealt with, the initial proposal did not have a brief, I don't know, for the academics. As they raised the issues with us to say, look, what if I'm the only author of a book, you know, of history that is subscribed to by maybe students of law and so on, of philosophy? Would my university be precluded from buying that book simply because I'm a professor of that university? And we said, no, I don't think that's what we want to stop. We want to stop a situation where the principal wants to build the new extension of Block A as a consequence of the money we've given for refurbishment or upgrading of buildings. See? But in those instances where I have produced a medicine to cure AIDS, you know, and the university wants it for their students who are infected and sick, then they should be able to buy. So that is the only little valve were giving to the professors and the scholars, persuaded by the submissions of the various scholars that came before us.
Thank you, Chair. Here the next clause is dealing with clause 4, and I want to refer to the document that we've also handed out, which is a incorporation of all these many 8 different amendments in order to make the reading and assist the members in understanding the extent of the amendment. Okay, if I can read from that, the section 4, capital A, subsection 1, the minister may, and then we take out the word direct and replace it with issue a directive to the board to take, we've taken out any, and insert such action specified by the minister if the NSFAS A is in financial difficulty or is being otherwise mismanaged, B is unable to perform its functions effectively due to dissension amongst board members, C has acted unfairly or in a discriminatory or inequitable way towards a person to whom it owes a duty under this Act, D has failed to comply with any law, E has failed to comply with any directive given by the minister under this Act, or F has obstructed the minister or person authorized by the minister in performing a function in terms of this Act. Here, sub 2, this clause reads, or subsection reads, a directive contemplated in subsection 1 must state A, the nature of the deficiency, B, the steps with which must be taken to remedy the situation, and C, a reasonable period within which the steps contemplated in paragraph A must be taken. Sub 3, there's amendment that we've, that we've inserted there as proposed by the committee. Before taking any action, we've taken that out and replaced it with making a decision under subsection 1, the minister must, subject to the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, 2000, Act number 3 of 2000, A, give notice to the board of the intention, as we've taken out, so to act and replace it to issue a directive, B, give the board a reasonable opportunity to make representations, and C, consider such representations. In sub 4, we've made the following amendment. If the board fails to comply with, we've taken our direction and replace it with directive, within the stated period, the minister may dissolve, we've inserted the following, it dissolves the board and appoint an administrator to take over, and we've taken out relevant function and replace it with functions of the board. Here, sub B, there's no changes to that. It reads, for the purpose of paragraph A, section 17, capital A, 17 capital B and 17 capital C applies with the changes required to the context. The sub sections 5 and 6 being deleted as it provided for a situation where the board coexisted with the administrator, and that was one of the issues that the committee instructed us to take out of the bill. The principle very clear, it's only a administrator or a board but not in coexistence. There's a new sub 5 reads, if the minister appoints an administrator in terms of subsection 4, the administrator may perform all the functions of the board, and an employee must comply with the directive given by the administrator. And then,
some of the wording differs slightly from what I have in front of me. Must we follow what is in writing or what is being read?
Just
example, Chair, if I've got the right document in front of me, 5 is inserted. 5. If the minister appoints an administrator in terms of subsection 4. Okay, sorry. Thank you, I've got it.
Sorry, Chair, I haven't read those as being deleted. The next important one is what is contained in subsection 7. Is this a one that's not been amended? It remains the same. The cost associated with the appointment of an administrator shall be for the account of the NSFAS. Then it is important that because that clause got an amendment to the Act of more than one section, it also referred to a section 4 capital B, and 4 capital B was one of those clauses which the committee felt must be deleted. If we go back to the A-list document, you would find in paragraph 8 that on page 4 from line 27 to omit section 4B. The section is therefore out and not part of the new bill. The next issue is...
Sorry, Chair, can I just ask, what is the new paragraph 6 there?
How
does that read?
I presume we are talking about...
There isn't one. And the 7 will be consequentially amended when the committee passes the A list. When the B bill comes out, all that numbering will be in accordance. For today's purposes, the numbers will be all over the place because we're still dealing with the numbering of the main bill. But when the committee adopts the amendments, then all those numbers will come right at the end of the process.
So this one will be consequentially
amended? Yeah, that will be consequentially amended later.
Thank you, Chair. So if we then move to Clause 5, Clause 5 of the bill is dealing with the dissolution of the board, and it is in ensuring that the board and the administrator do not coexist. It was necessary to rework this specific clause. Here we've already indicated that in in section 4 capital A, we've inserted subsection 4A. A additional language to include the dissolvement of the board and to appoint the administrator, which is an aspect that was dealt with by this clause 5, the 7 capital A, section 7 capital A as proposed by the bill. Here we've also then moved the rest of that section to section 17 and as a new 17D that's been proposed here, and therefore it takes the need to have a section 7 capital A out of play. It was important in the past because there was a coexistence and to arrange to regulate that existence. But that is not the position anymore. I will deal with that clause when we get to the new proposed clause 17D. If we then move to the next clause, which is the clause 6. The clause 6 is dealing with amendments on page 5 of the bill, and it is dealing with section 17A, capital A, capital B, and capital C. Here, once again, a separate document has been provided to assist members to look at and get a better understanding of the implications of the different amendments. Here, this clause is dealing with the Chapter 2, Capital A, and the appointment of the administrator. There is no change to the language used in the 17, Capital A, Sub 1, but in Sub 2, it had to be amended. And here, if I can read Sub 2 to the committee, the minister may only act in terms of subsection 1 and A and Sub B if, and then it deletes the following, the board has failed to resolve the maladministration or undermining contemplated in subsection 1A or B, as the case may be, within the period determined by the minister. And here, once again, this being deleted because the committee view has been clearly stated that you're either functional or you're dysfunctional, and if you have embezzled money, you can't get an opportunity to correct it. It is not possible. And that's why that language has been deleted. And then the section continues to say, appoint an administrator. The appointment of an administrator is in the best interest of the NSFAS higher education in an open and democratic society. Here, that is part of what was in the old section 7A, and therefore it moved into this clause, which is in order to avoid a repetition of the same concept. Here, it then continues with 17A sub 3, and which deals with the minister appoints an administrator for such period as may be determined by the minister, that such period may not exceed 2 years, and the minister may extend the period contemplated in paragraph A once for a period not exceeding 6 months. The provisions of 17B and C have not been changed, but if we go back to the other document, there is a proposed that after C, a new 17D be inserted, which reads dissolution of the board of board. This is the heading that you would also find in 7 capital A of the bill, and it would read the board is dissolved from the day the minister appointed the administrator in terms of 17A, capital A, 3A. Once again, it cleans up the issue of the coexistence between the fact that there is no coexistence between an administrator and the board. These are the amendments as the committee asked us to look at. The last one is just a technical amendment, and that is in the long title. There's been reference to staff, and we've just corrected to employees to be consistent with the rest of the role. Thank you, Chair.
Colleagues? Yes, Ms. McQueen.
When we go back to the A list, the first page, and let me say the eighth line from the bottom, council has followed a due process. It will start from 7D. A member of the council or a committee of council who contravenes subsections, all that, when you get to B there, it says may be disqualified as a member of council. And I'm wondering whether there's no need to also add or committee of council, because it refers to on page 3, on page 3, under 7, that's the last paragraph, the fourth clause 4. Under 7, it says business referred in subsection 4 relates to conduct that is aimed at receiving any direct or indirect financial personal gain. And I thought the conflict of interest goes beyond financial gain. Or whether we needed to say unrelated benefits in that particular regard. But it's a financial qualified. That's why I'm saying perhaps there's a problem when you qualify to be financial, whether it's direct or indirect. It says direct or indirect financial personal gain. I thought we may need to look at whether it may need to include other. No, even if financial is there, but I'm saying it's not limited to financial gain, probably. To assist the chair, where did I see this?
Yes, Chair. We could possibly just amend it by removing the financial, and then it would be indirect and direct gain. Broader. Yeah.
But under page 3 of the amendments, the initial one, page 3, Roman figure 2, on E, it says may not have a direct or indirect financial, personal, or other interest in any matter to be discussed. But I'm saying if it the amendment or removal of financial will then cover whatever gain, then as well it could be fine. But I'm just saying let's not limit it to financial gain, because then it means any other gain in kind is fine. The last one, which I'm just thinking, Chair, what becomes our own understanding, that suppose in a year, isn't it the board is there for a period of 4 years, once appointed by the minister. In the event that, say, in a year's time or year plus, it's found to be financial difficulties and so on, whatever the challenges are, to the extent that they must be dissolved. and is dissolved, an administrator is in place. The administrator runs for 2 year period, and somewhat there's a need to extend by six months. And we are left with about 6 months or so before the end of the term. What I'm trying to drive, I think will be understood. We are left with about 6 months or 8 months or whatever, but it's not right at the end of the term. And after that, you may need to appoint a new board. What happens in that regard? Does the minister go ahead and appoint a new one to complete the term for 8 months and either renew them after the term has concluded, or the minister can as well extend it to conclude that term and appoint a new board in the new term that is supposed to be coming?
The term is as it is applicable to the minister appointing any council, and therefore it is provided a limit to the time frame, but not a specific period. And it's a new council that's been appointed, so it is not to full. The language of the bill is not limiting it to just carry the old term of office. It is a new determination that the minister will make.
Yeah, I'm understanding it to say once the administrator is done, the minister appoints a new board which runs across. You don't count the
May I just, and I believe this is something which would have been dealt with in Law 101, but I haven't got Law 101. The word "and," if we say the supplier is a sole provider and it is in the best interest of the institution, can you just explain the implications of that word "and"? And then also, if I may just ask, would this act apply to the staff member that you've referred to as an author of a textbook, but that staff member is not the publisher of that book, so he hasn't got it's not his business that he must declare, and they're not procuring from this staff member, but yet the staff member is going to benefit from when they prescribe that textbook, or if the library wants to buy those books, etc. I'm afraid that we might getting a bit too close to some of that and make it difficult for universities to obtain certain services. Thank you.
From our table, if you can.
As has been indicated yesterday, the issue of your conflict of interest is a matter that is very difficult to define, and it is not always even worth the proposals that's been made to the committee. It comes back to the language that's used in this section in order to address the different possibilities. It is clear that the direct or indirect gain, personal gain, is what is the criteria that's been used. And a person who got a unique product The example that was used by Professor Moore was that one of the thumbprint on the device to do roll call during lectures. That's a unique product. There's a patent on it, and it is justified within the best interest of the institution. That's covered. A book, which is a unique book, which is cover a specific aspect, which is not covered by any other book, it is provided for. It is possible that deviation can be allowed. But yeah, if it is a normal book, which is there's a number of other competitors also in the marketplace, then it is unfair to have a person who got a decision-making function in the institution to take a decision which provides that personal gain. But the answer to the last part of the question is definitely will affect a person unless that book is a unique book. If it is unique, then it is justified. Here on the word of and, the word and includes all three those criteria that's been listed in A, B, and C as a combination. If it was all, then it would have been any one of those, or all three as a combination. The saying is and is a combination, or also includes and.
As I understand it now, and please then confirm, it means that the librarian of a university, because all textbooks authored by different people are unique, that the librarian of such a university may not buy a copy of that textbook for reference purposes in the library unless the council has first taken a decision on that. Is that the implications of what we have in front of us?
The institution may decide. If they feel this is in the interest of the institution to purchase this book, and this book of history titled this is published by these publishers, authored by Dr. Klopas. Then Klopas will even tell us, look, my book has been purchased here, so that then we know. The context of that provision is to ensure that there is openness, there is fairness, and there's not abuse of power by people in an institution. Because currently, it's possible that if I am maybe a principal, I could as well purchase my books, and they are subscribed, and everybody has got to buy my books in the university or the college. And that is what we want to deal with.
Sorry, but what I've said then, it does apply. It's true that a librarian may not buy a book authored by one of the university staff members unless the council has first taken a decision on that.
I don't understand that.
A book which is written much different from another book, because otherwise it is copyright infringement. So there is uniqueness when it comes to a book. The next one is that the publisher of that specific book is a sole provider. They seldom provide a license to others. And then lastly is a very important one of the interest, the best interest of the institution. It's the best interest of the institution to have resource material. And therefore it is not a precluded. We are talking about a very limited number of copies for research purposes. And it is therefore in the best interest of students to have access to it to compare. But it is a different issue if it is a handbook prescribed to all students, which is a issue which there might be other competitors, and therefore to prescribe that one as the only one and to procure it through the university in order to ensure that all students must have that handbook, that is the type of situation which will not be tolerated.
See, I just wanted to say, if the member said that if the librarian procures an item written by somebody else, in this clause, the employee themselves, in other words, if the librarian wrote a book, then that would be a conflict if it doesn't go through this test. But if some other professor wrote it, the librarian has other criteria of evaluation, and these may form part of that, and they may make that, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. I think I would just beg to differ. I think that if we look at sub 5, it says an employee. And if we go back to the Principal Act, an employee is defined as anybody who's employed at that institution, whether you're academic, whether you're catering staff, whether you fly chips, you are an employee of that institution. And I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to regulate processes. And this speaks to a process. And I think that what the member is saying is that if we have an employee who has a book, and the librarian has now come to know of this book, and it is a resource that's going to be in the best interest of the institution, and this book is only available as a copyright to this particular employee, and we can only get it through one sole provider, then yes, it has to be approved by council. And I think that is what the member was asking. Mm-hmm. So he was asking about the process, and yes, we have to go through council for that procurement to be authorized. That's what this provision says.
May I just point out that it has got profound implications for procurement processes at the university libraries in the future. And I'm not sure if we're not going too far now with this, because the business interest may be the royalties of, you know, 50 cents on a copy of the book. And now we, and people who are outside this will be able to will be on the wrong side of the law, and I just think we're being too harsh here. And we may find ourselves throwing the baby out with the bathwater if we go this far. Thank you.
Look, we are dealing with a general provision, and a university will have to structure a supply chain management system that responds to this clause. How do you manage the process of procurement in your own institution? In instances where there will be professors at the University of Cape Town, many of them have written many books that are in use. There will be a system in which they're able to say, look, this is how we approve of books in this year. We have got 7 professors whose books are purchased, blah, 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 blah. The thing is, if we open this valve, Then the issue is then we're saying that they must just be trading. Here we're controlling, so it council could still have a system in which it is able to permit such transactions, or make, let's say if you purchase, for instance, in procurement in the public service, we're saying if you purchase something above 500,000 rand, it must go through this route. It's a way of controlling. Yeah, but an official, they can get 3 quotations, for instance, for something worth 250,000 rand at the moment. So they will do that at that level through regulations in their various institutions, so that then we should not have an open system where anybody could just do anything. Yeah. Any further input? Yes.
I take it we're done with the other one. On this one about the appointment of the administrator, that when the other A and B has happened, then the administrator may be appointed. C then says, when that is upon the request from the board to say, dissolve us, there's need for an an administrator. The view may be that rarely happens, that people will call on their own dissolution or disbandment. But perhaps it may happen that some within that board may feel that nothing is moving, either clash of personalities or whatever, and start calling for such an action to say, why don't you dissolve us and put the new. But again, there's need for that kind of report so that we are able to understand why they should be dissolved. So the view as well could be that even if they don't call on you to disband them, that report is required and you can ultimately disband them. So I'm just saying that voluntary action, which rarely happens, also can share, yeah, at what point such things happen where people will say, it's like we're no longer serving the purpose. Why don't you exercise your powers to remove us from the board and put a new one?
Thank you, Chair. I think that yesterday's consultation, yesterday's deliberations on the board has actually, I think, given a good background to the question that we're facing today. Yesterday, members were saying that when we bring in an administrator, the board shouldn't be around. It should be the administrator arrives, board is gone. Now, if we look at 17(a)(1), it says that the minister may ask for consultation with the board if practical. Now, looking at the subsidy, which the member just indicates the board requests such appointment, if there is a frivolous call to the minister to disband, or for whatever reason certain board members goes to a minister to say, please disband us, that is where 17(a)(1) could kick in and the minister could then consult the board to say, is this request legitimate? What is actually going on here? So there is a mechanism to counter that sort of frivolous request. And if a request of certain board members is legitimate and there's a need for it, then the minister would be acting in terms of legislation to then disband that board.
Thank you. And I know that we had different views on that aspect. Some say, no, it can't be. A board must not request the dissolution. And others say, yeah, well, they could. So I'm still prepared to hear you again now and for the last time. What do you say? You are here, the decision maker. Of course, in abstract terms, it is possible. But in situation of corruption, I find it difficult that the council could sit and say, we are corrupt, we are incompetent, dissolve us. For me, I find it practically difficult to occur. Every council always says we are fine, we are happy, we'll rehabilitate, we will strengthen, you know. But if you find it in your wisdom that it must be here, but I'm imagining that all those from A and B in themselves cater for C, because if there's maladministration, any one of them can just write it and say, we are dealing with corrupt people here. Dissolve this board. It's sufficient. Do we really have to have another subsection clearly saying the board may? But anybody from the board, even a citizen, my grandmother could just stumble over a problem of the board, you know, and she could, he could just. That's the issue. Let's discuss it. It's for you to make, Honorable Gina.
Chair, I think it's proper we leave it there, because really, as a member of the board, you might see some of the problems that might arise. But I think we must be comfortable if it will be covered. But by what has been said, is to say, but if the minister has been alarmed of that, the processes, due processes must be followed. The consultation, then the minister might take that decision. Not that once the board member has has come up with, then the board must be dissolved. But I think it's proper to chair. Really, there are things that board members might have that internal knowledge of which they can be able to raise alarm as to say there is something wrong within the board.
Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure. The honourable member mentioned a member, but the board is not a member. I think we must distinguish between a member of the board and the board. Please help me. Am I missing something?
Something. That is the debate. Because a board means a properly constituted board decision. Because any member is not a board. Or three members who don't form a quorum are not a board. Now, I'm imagining a scenario where a fully constituted board says, we are a problem to you. Disband us. I'm just saying, the lawyers will also help us. Let's go to the fact.
Yeah, now, Chair, I think that is a remnant of the other amendments.
Mm.
If there was coexistence of the board and the administrator, in some cases, the board may request the minister to assist by bringing an administrator. In this case, if it's not there, also it doesn't matter, because in this case, the board no longer coexists. And so, therefore, in any case, if the board wants to resign, they can resign. And the minister can manage the...
this subsection is superfluous. It's as good as absent. Pro non scriptum. So, I don't know.
It's interesting that we do have a situation in our education where one of the universities requested the minister to dissolve them and to appoint an administrator. So it is already in practice that you would have find a board coming to such a decision that you couldn't imagine. So, Chair, the important thing here is that if you the minister must appoint the administrator, what you would find in that list of criteria in subsection 1 is a objective criteria against which the minister must take the decision. And A and B need some evidence. Need some proof.
Mm-hmm.
While C is, if a board is saying you're not interested anymore, then you don't need that same level of proof. And that is why it is a very important provision. It is making the appointment, the process to appoint, much easier, because there's clearly a dysfunctionality. It's not disputed. There is no possibility of a dispute, because the party that could dispute is actually requesting it, and therefore it is important that it remains.
Advocate
Boshoff, are you referring to then a council of a certain university now? I just want to make that sure.
The full council decision.
I thought
we needed to accommodate both views, because there is possibility that the board may not be able to sit and agree on that, but quite a number, sizable number of board members may be having such a problem or a view that the board should go. Now, instead of elevating it to the board as a whole, we can say a board or some members of the board request such an appointment.
So, in that instance, then you may need a threshold.
Mm-hmm.
You may need some threshold so that if I'm angry as a member, I must not cause the board to go. If I'm so influential, I'm a friend to the minister, and I'm angry with the chairperson and the CFO over something, and I write the minister, dissolve the board. So it might need a threshold. Maybe let's leave it as it is. It will be very difficult to achieve in any case. We can leave it as it is. It is fine, but I know it will be difficult to... How do you close the debate?
Jefferson, no, I'm in agreement now. I'm quite happy that it stays. Because I think Advocate Bosoff sketched it very well for us by leaving that third section there. By request for that the board be appointed, so I'm happy with it staying.
Now, in the same page, down there you're saying the NS5 and higher education. Why don't you just add and training? You know, you're saying higher education. NS5 these days also funds FETs. So I think you must also add. And training, so that we don't exclude them. Yeah. They'll be happy to see that we recognize them in this period. Yeah.
Is this we adding?
You know, on the same page as we go down after the bold clause there. There is a writing that the appointment of an administrator is in the interest. Of the NSFAS and higher education in an open and democratic society. Are you? Yeah, okay. Are we finished in this area? Of linguistics, but the scholars will just look at it wherever there are those linguistic challenges. Interest.
Chair, just one clarity on 17B, where it says an administrator appointed in terms of section 17A. May, with the approval of the minister, appoint another person with suitable knowledge and experience. I just want to find out if this ministerial approval is readily available. And what happens if the minister does not approve?
I'm thinking the reason for that is that a board may not extend itself, what is the proper concept? You find that a board must be constituted by three people, suddenly there are seven, and when you ask them, they say, no, these are our appointees at our discretion. They want the minister to approve in case they are to employ, let's say they want to have a legal advisor in their board, they want to have a financial advisor in their board, they would like to have an economist in their board to assist them. In terms of course, now the board must deal with matters of fundraising and all that to optimize the resource base of NSFAS and all that.
Okay, you are not the same question. Also, the issue there's also financial implications with the appointment, and therefore it is important that there is some control.
over the appointment of the approval of such a request. The complexity of managing and govern an institution of this nature, a fund of this nature, obviously requires a lot of different disciplines, and therefore there's a need, and the minister would have an obligation to consider a request of this nature within the ambit of the administrative law, consider all the relevant facts, and must be able to provide reason for such a decision. So it is not just dismissing a request. So the honourable member can rest assured there is some checks and balances built into the administrative law to ensure that it is properly considered.
Yeah, no, Chair, I just wanted to say simply, the administrator takes over all the duties and functions of the board and cannot be the player and the referee at the same time. So that's also a conflict issue. That at least you need somebody that the administrator, otherwise they can go happy appointing, in terms of the powers that they have, appointing additional personnel. So that's just an additional safeguard.
Chair, I understand all these things. But I'm not talking about a minister who is disapproving in bad faith. I'm talking about a minister who has come across evidence to the effect that the person appointed by the administrator is not a fit person or a proper person. Then my question is, what happens if the minister does not approve?
That administrator must ask for another person to be appointed so that the minister can approve. There must be some consensus on the appointment of such a person.
The appointment is invalid, and therefore it cannot. Well, but if I'm appointed or rather I'm in the office, the minister may have to go to a court of law to review that appointment. He may not take a sambok and come in there and kick me out.
Because you can't be appointed before the minister has agreed.
Which question? 17B. The wording of appoint any other person, that does that apply singular and plural? Because in your initial document, you refer to persons.
The slides that have been provided is obviously not drafted within the rules that are applicable to drafting legislation. Legislation are always drafted in the singular, except if it is specifically the intention to have it in the plural. And the Interpretation Act provides then the flexibility that the singular will also include the plural. So if it is in the plural, then it means there must be more than one person appointed. It can't just be a singular one. But if you draft it in the singular, then it means it can be one or as many as approved by the minister. It just provides that flexibility.
Does it mean in terms of the member of staff versus employee, any place where there's a member of staff, it will be employee? That's what the consensus is.
Chairperson, those words have been corrected in the A list. Members will see, particularly, I think it's from sub 4 clause, we used to use the word employee, whereas in the bullet was member of staff.
The Further Education and Training Colleges Amendment Bill. The amendment that's been proposed there is purely to deal with the issue relating to conflict of interest. That's the only directives that we've got from the committee. Here, the language that's been used have been provided yesterday. There have been a few small technical adjustments to references and from the document that's been proposed in order to ensure that the state law advisors and the parliamentary law advisor also looked and picked up editorial amendments. But here on substance, it is exactly in line with the higher education approach, and here it is also the references being in line with those of the Act. Here, there's no new amendments to it, and this document is therefore is not a need to explain it with a separate document as the previous one, because the substance of it is self-explanatory. I've read it in the document or the similar provisions in the Higher Education Laws Amendment Bill. I'm not sure if you want me to read it again, but it is exactly the same as it was presented to the committee yesterday. It is basically just a provision to add three additional subsections to the existing Clause 8. Clause 8 of this bill, the FET Colleges Bill, is dealing with the council, the composition and the powers of the council, and here it is adding the conflict of interest relating to them functioning within the current legislation. Here the next clause that's being proposed is dealing with an amendment to Clause 12. This is the clause that's dealing with the staff of the college, and it provides also an addition to what is proposed in the bill, and it is dealing with the aspect pertaining or the issues as we've dealt with in terms of the Higher Education Act. Here, obviously, the amendments that have been raised early on and I'm now referring to subsection 10, which is in clause 12. It also referred to direct or indirect financial personal gain. Here, that word financial should then also be deleted as per the discussion early on. But other than that, there's no issue that's been changed or anything new that's been proposed in this amendment, in these amendments. Thank you, Chair.
Agreed, colleagues.
Thank you, Chair. May I just ask that you go to 9A and 9B, and it may quite well be that we have just dealt with a similar clause. It is just, again, to my lay mind, a bit of a strange wording to say in legislation that we say any person may in writing inform the chairperson of a meeting before the meeting of a conflict or a possible conflict of interest of a member of the council of the public college in question, of which such person may be aware. Just again, if you could just explain to me, it doesn't mean that such a person may not orally also inform the chairperson. The second thing is, I think the reason why it said in writing is that because in the next paragraph it says, but if the chairperson has received in writing such a notice, it seems to me that the chairperson must then ask that person or inform such a person of such a letter or note, and then convey that to the member concerned, and then ask that person to recuse him or herself. But I do find it stricter in the fact that it must be in writing. Is there a particular reason why some oral information could not be shared, and secondly, then leave it to the chairperson to, in the meeting, say, inform and then request the person to recuse him or herself? If it's pointed out to such a person that he or she may have such a conflict of interest.
And just before the debate, there was one judge who was asked whether he had obtained permission from the minister to engage in business. And it was alleged that there was a verbal engagement around such matters, mm-hmm. and the minister had already passed on, or yeah, I think so. And now it was difficult to say that was not done, you know, because nobody could controvert the statement of the judge to this day, you know. We still debate in our blocks when we debate there, we still raise such issues. That's why a written submission is necessary, mm-hmm. because these are matters of record. They involve very serious decisions. A council may just say, we don't remember, but that could have been done, you know. And now it's in a court of law, and there's no proof that this person hadn't done that. Now, you see, maybe that's the reason why it must be in writing.
Okay, you're absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. And over and above that, it is, when the chairperson has it in writing, it is the specific allegation is contained in the words of that person who actually brings it to the attention. If it is orally, it is the understanding of the chairperson and his or her interpretation to it, which is then transferred or communicated to the council, which might not be the same. And that is where you often find that rumors got tails to it. And you don't want that on a serious issue like this. So, Chair, it is important that one must be correct, we must be clinical, and the actual facts must be presented. And the only way to do it is in writing.
I had the other correction on the financial one. I somehow did not hear you mentioning the one on page 1B, on council or committee of council. Maybe qualified as a member of the council or committee of council, in line with what is 9B up.
Yeah.
So equally it should be changed. Chair, when we talked to this conflict of interest, I remember us going into organs of power in the institution, and that was inclusive of SRC. But I don't think we're still referring to that or have them covered somehow, unless if I'm missing something in the documentation that I have. The explanation given by Advocate Boshoff yesterday was that in the ambit of committees of council, that's where they take decisions. It will cover also members of the SRC. You may not have to specify the SRC in particular. But they can still explain.
Whether
an SRC is a committee of council per se.
In terms of the
As I remember, it is an organ of governance, one of the organs. The VC, the council, the FMC, and the institutional forum.
The approach has been that those structures that making decisions are those that have been included when it comes to the issues pertaining to procurement, and where it is providing financial benefits to those decision makers. The interpretation or the understanding that we've got from the presentation being that in your council and committees of council, you would find that the delegated functions would be to deal with procurement aspects. And therefore, it is council and committees of council that must be included, and not all the other structures that's more of a policy-making function. Your institutional forum, your student council, they are not dealing with procurement as such. They are dealing with policy relating to their constituency, and therefore it's not included.
Fine, perhaps our experiences may be different in this regard, because at times SRCs develop their sort of program, submit to council, and that's how they are funded. And millions are given to them, and I don't think necessarily they go through the procurement of the institution mainly. They do procure on their own at times, in which case they decide what they want, you know, as and when they utilize that those funds. And I do not think that honorable member, let's all be, yeah, that's fine, you're welcome. We remain friends regardless. I wanted to simply say that I don't think they account from time to time to council necessarily like committees of council. Perhaps they do provide the expenditures or whatever, how they expended those money. But they operate more like independent from council, you know, doing their own things. If they have to hire taxis, for instance, they've got a trip to Devon or KwaZulu-Natal, I don't think they go via council to say, hire taxis from Avis or whoever to take us there. They do it on their own. And all we're saying was to try and keep the situation where you've got corrupt activities in that space. And often, students themselves know that if this SRC is corrupt or not, they know, and they deal with that by way of taking people out of office. You know, that kind of thing. They don't use legal or other means. They revert to taking them out of office if they are corrupt or something like that. And we do have such cases.
Consider this. I just want to draw the attention to what is in 9 capital E B Roman 1, which is that each member of council, each member of council committee, and each person who exercise functions of council in terms of delegated authority. So if that's been delegated, that person will also be covered. And that is part of the declaration and the rules that the institution must develop in order to keep all these different structures, which we might not know of, intact and ensure that they comply with their responsibility in terms of this clause.
Chair, just so that the record will reflect this, we, and hopefully will not come as a surprise to you now after what I've said yesterday, we are opposed to the fact that the FET colleges are now being nationalized or made national competency. Secondly, we believe that this amendment bill has omitted a few other changes which we would have liked to see in here, such as, you know, looking at the composition of FET college councils to strengthen those councils, and then also the fact that the council's role as an employer is decreased here through these changes. We cannot go along with that. And I just need to put that on record. We have got a different view. We would have liked to see the college councils to be more autonomous and to take on greater responsibility linked to them being empowered to carry those additional responsibilities. So when we deliberate on this act, obviously this is a fundamental difference of opinion to what this act proposes. Obviously we will try where we can to improve in the current format, you know, the act, and make it as good as possible, but those fundamental differences we must report. Thank you.
Noted. I'm certain that even in the debate which you'll have on the 20th, you'll be reflecting on all those. Now, what is going to happen is that on Tuesday we are going to receive what do we receive? We receive the final version. Final version on Tuesday. When is it? It will be sent to members in good time. I'm being advised by Annele here. Yeah? But on Tuesday, what time are we meeting? 9 o'clock. We're going to approve clause by clause, accordingly, and finalize the matter. Yes.
I would like to suggest that we meet at 9:30 as usual, because I won't be able to make it. I have to take the early flight from Oliver Tambo. And what is good time? What do you use? Okay, and when will we get the document? Not even 12 hours before. We needed 48 hours before our meeting, according to the rules of this parliament.
Chairperson, what will happen now is that the A-list will probably be finalized by tomorrow afternoon, and then it will have to be sent to committee section, and CLEDA will have to print. And we are now on a Wednesday, which we would get it done by tomorrow afternoon. Friday, it will go to committees, and they would send it to CLEDA. CLEDA will probably come back with a print on Monday, and at Monday it will probably be ready to be circulated to members. That's the process behind the scenes that we have to follow now.
Sorry, sir, I understand that the printing of hard copies will take some time, but would it be possible to submit that electronic version that you will probably submit to CREDA to members then?
When?
On Friday then.
That's fine that I'll try and do that. Already, of course, we do have it in, on our files, but it's fine. They'll try and do that. Then we'll approve it accordingly, and we've noted all the issues. I must take this moment to thank officials from the department, to thank the state law advisor, to thank the